This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not. How best to learn history? Is it by reading dry historical tomes or by learning with characters and enjoying an action-packed romp? It's all in Hunt for the Nighthawks by Felicia Arena. Welcome.
Thank you, Jan. Thank you so much.
Hunt for the Nighthawks.
Catchy title.
Yeah, but I've never heard of what a Nighthawk is.
I know,
what
right?
is it?
And Nighthawks are illegal treasure hunters who go out into the middle of the night with their metal detectors, digging up history and treasure and selling it on the black market.
Look, I didn't even know there were rules about metal detectors.
Oh, yeah, there are. I mean, it's a popular hobby in the UK and in Australia, but you do need permission. And whatever you discover, even a Roman coin, you need to report it.
Well, another way to locate Roman ruins is aerial photos. Well, this is what I've read from your book. In one area of land, if it's particularly good crops growing on it, this may not be just fertiliser.
No, exactly, exactly. And I learned about this through my archaeologist friend from the University of Cambridge, Rob, when he took me up for a dig. Yeah, so it was new for me and I found it fascinating. I just thought it was like the movies, Indiana Jones, you know. I was looking for the rolling balls, but there was more to it than that.
Well, we are talking ancient Roman coins and things, so we're not talking Australia. Where's the book set?
It's set in Cambridge, in the English countryside, just outside of Cambridge.
30 kilometres from Cambridge. Mm-hmm. At one time, there's a chase in Cambridge, and we get a bit of a tour. There's punting on the River Cam, the Great Gate of Trinity College, and Wren Library.
Yes, running past Wren Library.
Where? What's one of the books of significance held
Winnie
here?
Winnie the Pooh.
Winnie the Pooh.
Yes, Winnie the Pooh.
And The Hunt for Nighthawks is also written for kids and has 12-year-olds as its characters. Jake is a London boy. What's he doing in this very small village?
Well, Jake is sent to stay with his grandmother. Going through some grief of his own. He's just lost his father and he's spending some time for the summer with his grandmother in a very small village just outside of Cambridge.
It's at night. He's the one who wakes up to find nighthawks in his nan's meadow.
Yes.
What
yes.
happens then?
So he really should wake up his grandmother, but he goes out to confront the nighthawks, who have masks so they cover up their identities. And get off my grandmother's property, what are you doing? They've just dug up a Roman skeleton, 1800 years old, with treasure, and they overpower poor old Jake and run off into the night.
With a knife threatening him, don't tell anyone or we'll come back for you and your family.
Yes, scary so stuff for a 12-year-old.
He meets and does tell Tilly, who explains about nighthawks, and her uncle, who works in Cambridge. What's her uncle's job?
An archaeologist, based on my friend, actually. So I based that character on my friend, who is does work at the University of Cambridge. And Tilly loves everything about her uncle, and maybe one day she might go into the same field, excuse the pun. And, and she also loves animals as well.
She does, especially foxes. So the area becomes a dig site, and the police are involved. There is something else disturbing Jake. He wonders whether he may have concussion or perhaps it's part of the grief that a therapist has told him he may have.
Yes, he starts to see this figure or some sort of apparition in the village of a young man in a toga.
Yeah, and it comes with a smell. We're going to hear from Felicia Arena reading from Hunt of the Nighthawks.
Suddenly, Jake feels a gust of cold air blow across the back of his neck. He shivers and feels goosebumps all over. Then he catches a whiff of a strong, strange scent. It's not totally unpleasant, but it's like a combination of charred, smoked wood and moss or cut grass that's been left a bit too long. When Jake turns, he is startled by a shadowy figure looming directly behind him. Ah! He cries, lurching for his bedside lamp and switching it on. There, standing by the window in his bedroom, is a young man in a toga.
And read beautifully, I must say.
Thank you. I've been throwing on my old acting days from a former life.
Felicia's just come from a children's festival where I think you engaged 400 children.
Exactly, 800 kids in a huge hall. There was a huge festival in Mackay in northern Queensland last week. And usually when I'm booked into schools around the country, they're usually around 100 or 200 in the session. And I don't mind these large groups. I have a lot of bells and whistles, get the kids involved. We have interactive, sort of almost like theatre sports, and bring my characters to life. But with this one, because it was just released, I thought, should I actually read to such a large group? Can I keep their attention? And I decided I would, and you could have heard a pin drop. And at the end of it, what really took me aback was they all applauded. Not so much about the applause for me, that was very nice, but what I realised was good old-fashioned storytelling is still alive in such a digital age and fragmented age, that here are these kids wanting me to read to them. And these were like kids 9, 10, 11, 12, even the teachers were engaged. Mm. So maybe there's something in this book. Or the performance. I'm not sure. But
I think you've got really good characters. Now, we talked about Tilly, but there's another 12-year-old, Leo, with the nickname Rabbit.
Yes, well, he tends to rabbit on, and that's a little bit of me as well. All my characters seem to be a little bit of me, but Rabbit does tend to... He's not a lonely kid. Well, he's kind of lonely, but he has his own story arc, and that is he's desperate for some friends and some besties. And Jake's, you know, his age, and this could be a potential bestie, best friend. And
yes,
what can I do?
They meet when he's playing the most atrocious soccer.
Yes, he's not very coordinated, but he wants to play soccer. Jake, we find out Jake loves his football, but after his dad's passing, he finds it hard to go back to that game. I mean, this is the undercurrent throughout the story. There is this adventure where Jake and Rabbit and Tilly go hunting for the Nighthawks, and it is a mystery story, but underneath it there is a current of friendship and bravery as well for all three kids.
And look, I've got to laugh about this because Rabbit has so many phobias.
He does. He's a quirky character, and it's hard not to fall in love with him. He's a quirky character. He has a phobia of water, phobia of birds. But when yes, he has a few phobias, and my editor and I had a lot of fun going back and
forth.
That's
a great character too many, trait.
Yeah.
And you give them all names. The kids will be quoting these, I can see.
Oh, I hope so.
I can't pronounce them. But there's one thing he's not scared of. He's a spookophile.
A spookophile, yeah. I thought that would be a little bit of fun because the one thing you'd think he'd be afraid of, he has all these phobias, he'd be afraid of ghosts, right? No, he actually loves it. Thinks it's great. And I think when Jake reveals there's apparently a ghost in his life, Tilly's so not really sort of, you know, what's going on here?
She's convinced.
I mean, even Jake doesn't really believe it in the beginning. But for Rabbit, he said, yeah, I'm with you all along.
And they'd get to know the ghost's name. It's Marcus.
That's right.
And what does Marcus want them to do?
Well, Marcus appears to, and first, as I said, Jake doesn't believe this. Maybe it's his grief playing tricks on him. But then he realises it's real, very real for him, and that possibly he starts to wonder, is Marcus the Roman skeleton that the Nighthawks had dug up in his grandmother's meadow? And Marcus asks Jake, I need you to retrieve the treasure so I can honour my family. Honour's huge for ancient Rome and ancient Romans, but also gain access to the underworld and be with his loved ones.
Yes.
So he's been roaming these fields for almost 2,000 years, and perhaps Jake might be able to help him return
and
to his loved
so
ones.
So we learn, as us readers, about the Elysian Fields.
We do.
Crossing the River Styx.
The River Styx, with the ferryman, Pay the Ferryman. Remember the song?
Yeah, I sure do.
Yes, Pay the Ferryman. And so he's needing some treasure, and I know that he needs the help of finding that treasure to gain that honour for his family. And perhaps the ferryman will help him cross to his family.
There's similarities between this Marcus from ancient Rome and Jake's father's.
Yes, so while Jake is dealing with his own grief, he's finding out a lot about Roman life through Marcus, but also personal life and how after 2,000 years, grief is still grief. And for Marcus, when he was young, he lost his father around the same age as Jake lost his father. I was incredibly sensitive when writing this book, and I was going back and forth with my editor, you know, writing for kids who might somewhere out there have lost a loved one. I was very aware of them while writing this book. But underneath it, can I say, there is a lot of hope rippling through it all. I always write my books and always end on hope.
The story starts with finding a skeleton. This was a real experience for you too.
This was, and I often say that my characters come and find me these days. I've been doing this for a long time, from writing sports to Bionic Heroes to historical novels. But now in the last 10 years, I often say I don't go and chase characters. Ideas come to me. And a couple of years ago, I was in Cambridge visiting my friend, who is an Aussie, as an archaeologist working at the University of Cambridge. He said, let's go on a dig, Felice. And I said, yeah, why not? Still thinking Indiana Jones, this will be exciting.
Yeah.
Went out there, and there was his team. And while we were there, they dug up an 1,800-year-old skeleton. I got to witness this, got to see that there was a pot of coins beside the skeleton. Why now? And like any good writer, they always ask questions when they have an idea. What would this Roman say to me? I couldn't let go of this, Jan. Uh-huh. I just thought, what would he say to me? What would I say to him? And I thought, this is an impetus. This is an impetus for our story.
Now, you've been writing for a long time, not as long as ancient Roman times.
It feels like it at times, it does, but I have, yes.
And I'd bought your Specky McGee footy books for my son, and now my grandson is reading them.
Yeah, it's hard to believe there. The first book came out 24 years ago, almost 25 years ago. I've been doing this for 30 years. I was first published in the UK. Prior to that, I was an actor for a couple of years, but also a school teacher, and that has played, I think all these roles I've played over in my life, I think for all of us, it just takes us to the next step of our lives. And for me, I found my sweet spot by writing for children.
When ancient Roman treasure is illegally dug up, three 12-year-olds and a ghost go into pursuit in Hunt for the Nighthawks, a children's book that parents will enjoy reading too, written by prolific author Felice Arena. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank
now,
you.
I'd like to introduce to you my author today, and I have debut author Aidan Pruitt here with me, and he has written The Picasso Ransom. Welcome, Aidan.
Oh, Lisa, thank you so much for having me. And Jan and Felice, so lovely to meet you guys.
Today, I'd love to just talk a little bit about this book. So The Picasso Ransom, it's a warm, funny crime novel inspired by Australia's most infamous art theft, the 1986 disappearance of Picasso's The Weeping Woman from Melbourne's National Gallery of Victoria. And the book combines this sort of historical mystery, but also there's some extremely memorable characters, and there's so much charm to this book. Now, some of these characters are based on real people, and some of them are, I think, entirely invented. Is that right, Aidan?
Absolutely, yeah. So the crime itself was August the 2nd, 1986, and there were some characters who were very, you know, prominent in the media at that time. The arts minister, Race Matthews, who was also the police minister, which is a really interesting association of portfolios.
Yeah.
And then there was the gallery director, Patrick McCackey, who was a very flamboyant character with spotted bow ties. In fact, he had different various colours of bow ties that he wore for every media appearance, even at the height of this heist when he was on the front page all across the country. He always still had his spotted bow ties.
He's begging to be written about.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So, and one of the characters, or the protagonist that you have created, I'm assuming you created her, is called Phoebe. And she's a woman who's about to turn 70. She is kind of tired of her retirement. And she, what I love about this character is she embarks on this sort of new chapter in her life at 70. And she blossoms. She is quietly rebellious, and she's restless, but she is incredibly surprising, let's just say that. Was there anything about this character that particularly surprised you?
Well, when I started writing this, I had an idea of who the protagonists were going to be, who were the three thieves of this painting, because to this day we don't know who it actually was.
Right.
We got the painting back. It was returned via locker 227 at Spencer Street Station, and there were two women witnessed apparently around about that time standing near that locker. So in my research, when I'm discovering who these characters are, I thought, well, who are these two women? Who could they be? And is it possible that they were the thieves? When the painting was returned, a male voice rang up the Age newspaper and he said, "The painting is returned. We are the Australian cultural terrorist. Remember us?" He said, "It's in locker 227 at Spencer Street Station. Ta-ta." And he hangs up the phone. So there's a male voice who I've created this character, David, who is he's an artist. And then our two female protagonists being Phoebe and Eva. And they're all in their late 60s, early 70s. They're mature age art students and they take the law into their own hands when they decide to steal a Picasso in protest against the closure of their art school.
So this is it's a really strong hook. You take it all the way to the end and it's a very compulsive read and it's a fun romp, I guess. I felt that way about it. So in terms of fleshing out the story, was that sort of quite difficult? Did you rely a lot on research?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I wore out my welcome at the three libraries that I'm a member of. And so I read everything I could, I watched everything I could, and I was trawling through archival footage too, because there was a lot televised at that time. So I wanted to make sure that the timeline of my novel is as accurate as can be. So we know exactly when the ransom notes arrived, we know when the painting went missing, we know when the government made certain statements, which are almost as funny as the ransom notes themselves.
Yeah.
So all of that stuff in the book is accurate timing-wise. But then I had a whole lot of blanks to fill in. What were the thieves doing during this time? Because we don't know who they were. Mm. We don't know where they were. We don't know where the painting was for the time it was missing. So I had so much fun filling in those blanks. At every turn, I said, okay, we've got to this point. Now, what's the most fun thing that can happen next?
Mm.
And oftentimes I found it was the characters leading me.
Yeah, you really got that sense of the characters constantly surprising. Was there a point where you felt like that character, Phoebe particularly, sort of leapt off the page for you? Did she sort of lead you, or were you planning mostly as you wrote?
I planned out the bones of the story.
Okay.
But when I really got my head around who Phoebe was early on in the first scene. I thought, okay, where is Phoebe? She's a retired English teacher. She's about 5 years into retirement and she's getting a bit antsy. She wants to be out there doing things. And she goes home, it's pouring with rain, she's left her umbrella inside, and then she meets, well, she opens the door and her cat is waiting for her. And it was just that very simple moment of somebody going home and they're in their own environment where they're comfortable after they're out, you know, they've been in the rain, but now they're nice and warm, and their cat comes to sit on their lap. And I just thought, okay, I think I know who this character is.
Mm.
Now that we've met her cat, who was named Mr. Bunbury.
I was about to say, please name the cat. Yes. Yeah, which is very cute and a great name. How did you discover this mystery initially? You know, how did you come across this?
This is the most fascinating thing, because if the police ever come to knock on my door and say, you know a lot about this case, is it possible that you did it? My alibi is quite a good one. I think I was in utero when it
probably
happened.
Okay. Yeah.
I was born 3 weeks after the painting was returned. I came into the world. So I hadn't heard of this case at all until 5 years ago. I was planning out what I thought would be a children's book about the history of Melbourne. Mm. And I was researching, okay, what are the quirkiest things? Of course, there's so many. This wonderful city we live in, there's so many quirky things that have happened over the years. But I had never heard of the Picasso ransom before. And so as soon as I came across this, I thought I have to ditch the picture book idea. This is a novel. And I started out with a short story and then very quickly had those three protagonists already, and they were itching to be explored further.
And when did you come across the tone or the genre for this piece? Was it always going to be a cozy crime novel?
It was always going to be a cozy crime novel, because the comedy that is inherent in the ransom notes themselves lends itself to just how much fun can we have?
Yeah.
How much fun. And also, you know, it's I think at the time in the world that we're in right now, it's nice to have a crime novel that's not violent in any way, that we just have more sort of plotting and planning and devious things going on, but the end result is just the theft of a painting, and it's not, there's no blood and guts.
There's no heads roll. Could I ask you to read one of those ransom notes?
Oh, absolutely.
Just so that we can get a sense, so that the listener can get a sense of the sort of comedy that we're ready for.
Absolutely. So the painting was stolen on Saturday night, which was the 2nd of August 1986, a nice rainy Melbourne evening. The painting, they didn't notice the painting was missing until the Monday morning, when a ransom note arrived at The Age, and The Age thought, oh, this is a hoax, but they'll ring the gallery just to, you know, double check.
I love the 80s.
They ring, oh, absolutely. They ring the Age rings the gallery and they say, hey, we've received a ransom note. Do you want to just go see if it's up on, is it there? Like, you've got it, right? The painting's on the wall still. The gallery goes and checks and the painting is gone. So The Age very quickly faxes over what the ransom note is. It was directed to Race Matthews, who was the police and the arts minister at the time. In my book, we've changed the name because the character Ray Montrose is quite different to who the real minister was. But here is the ransom note that arrived on the Monday morning. Attention, rank Montrose. We have stolen the Picasso from the National Gallery as a protest against the inadequate funding of the fine arts in this hick state and against the clumsy, unimaginative stupidity of the administration and distribution of that funding. Two conditions must be publicly agreed upon if the painting is to be returned. One, the minister must announce a commitment to increasing the overall funding of the arts by 10% in real terms over the next 3 years. Two, the minister must announce a new annual prize for painting open to artists under 30 years of age. Five prizes of $5,000 are to be awarded. The fund is to be established to ensure that the real value of the prizes is maintained each year. The prize is to be called the Picasso Ransom. Because the Minister for the Arts is also Minister of Plod, we are allowing him a sporting 7 days in which to try to have us arrested while he deliberates. There will be no negotiation. At the end of 7 days, if our demands have not been met, the painting will be destroyed and our campaign continue. Your very humble servants, Australian cultural terrorists.
I love it. The whole thing is just crying out to be put into a novel, which you have done very successfully. Were there, in your research, were there any sort of little hints that you, do you think you could perhaps reopen the case? I mean, did you discover any sort of things that kind of changed the direction of your writing, I guess, in a way?
While I was writing, I wanted to fill in who on earth writes like that. Who? What characters?
Yeah.
And of course, they're going to be kooky and funny. Who is writing that ransom note? Who has that style of cadence and those wonderful words? And in some of the later ransom notes as well, they refer to the minister as a steaming a pile of swamp gas. Good luck with your huffing and puffing, minister, and all sorts of fun things like that. So I wanted to know who on earth has a vocabulary that is so wonderful. And of course, a retired English teacher, I think, is the perfect answer to that. I also love that the prizes, given that the ransom note asks for prizes for people under 30, either, yes, the criminals were under 30 and they want prizes for their people, or that's a wonderful red herring to say, hey, police, we're under 30, when in actual fact, as they are in my book, significantly older.
Mm, yeah, clever device. So I also loved in this book how there were so many Melbourne references. And, you know, this book is about sort of highlighting the arts and how we really need to support the arts financially a lot more, which is still unfortunately very relevant today as it was in 1986. Was this a component for you as when you were writing this book? Was this something that was important
Absolutely,
for you?
Absolutely. And I think as the book was being written, We've seen slashing of funding across the board, and it's disappointing, to say the least. So I absolutely was infusing as much of that as I could into the book, without being too on the nose about it. But I think it's an important discussion to be had, and I do hope that by reading this book, people will prick up their ears a little bit more to the importance of arts funding and funding for community arts and community radio, community services that are offered by this station and other services like it. We're very lucky in this state to have such an incredible wealth of arts, and it's such a shame to see that the funding is just not being provided.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And it's funny how things kind of come full circle and it seems that we don't learn.
It's a huge shame. I mean, as people, I think we learn, but politicians seem to struggle with that, don't they?
Yeah. In terms of your own background, I know that this was initially a short story and then somehow you expanded this into a novel. Was that a difficult process?
I found it fairly straightforward, actually, because in the writing of the short story, it was immediately apparent that there was much more to be said here. There were so many more questions that I had, and the characters themselves wanted to say more. So I couldn't hold back. I just had to get the pen out and go for it. Yeah.
Okay, so this was an easy book to write in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just had a ball with it. It literally was asking, what's the most fun thing that can happen next? And away we go.
What was particularly enjoyable for you in the writing? Was it the moment that the painting was stolen?
That was a really special moment, actually, because one of the things that I really didn't find in my research was what was the feeling, what was the emotion of creeping into the gallery at night? The lights are all out. There were only two security guards who just once an hour they did a lap. That was all the security. There was no CCTV. There were no motion sensors. But what was the emotion of walking up to that painting, removing it from the wall, and then going, I've done it. I've committed, this is a serious crime now. This painting at the time was worth $2 million. It's now worth almost $100 million. It's just, I wanted to know what was the what was running through the person's head as the moment they took that painting off the wall.
Yeah, scary. It becomes sort of something light and easy and then suddenly extremely heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially, I won't say anymore because I'm scared I'm going to give something away. And I noticed that you also have a background in documentary filmmaking. Is that something that influenced the writing of this book as well?
Definitely. I think because I'm trained in nonfiction, particularly in the film world, I wanted to know everything. I wanted to leave no stone unturned and find out as much as I possibly could in order to make it the most realistic telling of this story that I could. And so the 2 years that I spent doing a Masters of Film and Television at the Victorian College of the Arts is right across the road from the National Gallery. So I would walk past it every day and I'd just wander in and go and check out the painting. So I knew already the geography of the space and just how close the art school actually is to the gallery. It was a fertile ground for a protest movement, given that they're students, and given that they're mature age students. I just thought it turned the idea on its head a little bit. But yeah, my own experience of the art school and of the gallery really, you know, found its way into the novel.
And, you know, it's so rich. Thank you so much for this wonderful book, The Picasso Ransom. The author, Aidan Pruitt, was published by Pan Macmillan. So thank you for coming along today, Aidan.
And I was speaking with Felice Urena and his book Hunt for the Nighthawks, and that's it for Published or Not this week.
Join us next week.
You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.